Hello, everybody, and welcome to a slightly different, not a Starman and the Boomer. I'm not sure what we're going to call this. It's more like Starman and the Researcher, to be fair.
Yeah, you'll need to come up with some sort of catchy nickname for me.
Yeah, we will do. It's interesting. I hope you sound okay, guys. This is me actually pushing out the stream for once. Now I am the stream pusher.
Become streamer.
become stream put. I don't know. What I kept calling Trig the stream pusher, which makes him sound like as a dude in a back alley being like, hey, you kids want some stream?
You want some Twitch? I got 10 a bag, man.
Get in a bag, it's Twitch, man. I got some Twitch. but no, Trig isn't here because he's unfortunately had a death in the family with his cat, who had to be put to sleep today and will be sorely missed, for she was a good cat.
Can we get a rep Rams in the
Yeah.
chat, please?
Rip Rami. Now it's been a bit of a rough day for Trig, so I thought I didn't want to do the whole 3 hours of Keynesianism whilst he was not on top form and also feeling it a bit, understandably. But it's yeah, well, the thing is, they're not a bit low, they just talk quietly. We're actually on the same microphone here.
Yeah, I'm just not loud like some people.
Yeah, that's why there's both of us here, but there's only one thing flashing. I don't know if I want to move the microphone as close to you as humanly
I don't
possible.
know, maybe that make it slightly more listenable.
Yeah, maybe I can talk a bit softer, I don't know. But it's yeah, this is literally an in the room broadcast kind of thing. So that's the kind of situation we're in.
We're almost budging on pirate radio.
It is. We're gonna have to get some MCs up in here. Also, hi Daryl. See you in the chat there. But yes, normal preamble. Thanks for joining us. There's a pinned link there for donations through Streamlabs. That's still the best way to donate to us. YouTube does take a 30% cut of all super chats, but we can get super chats because we are somehow fully monetized. Yeah, I have to sit 3 feet away from the mic because of my booming voice. There's a join button down there to sound like a complete YouTuber. That's probably the best recurring way to support us right now, since we don't have the critical mass for a Subscribestar or, God forbid, a Patreon.
Oh no.
But we do have
We should just upload other stuff in OnlyFans, that'll work.
only. I don't know. I think you have to deliver the goods on OnlyFans. I think you have to actually get naked. Otherwise, like, they will take you off the service if you like promise naked pictures and don't deliver.
Yeah, but this is the equivalent of like intellectual porn, so.
I guess it is. But yeah, speaking of members, I think we've got the same members for the last little while, but we do have a few of you guys. So thank you to James Merry, Portrait Seal, HK9410, The Real Yaddle, Be Happy, Socratic, I can never say that.
Socadict, something like
Canadianistan,
that.
Velculus, Wig, Cerberain, Windtalker, and Wes. Thank you guys for joining. Your recurring support is important, and it does help this channel, still exist. It's beer money, but it is still money. So thank you for all the support again. And yeah, well, I guess you're now the non-silent partner there.
Oof, yes, I suppose. Yeah, I think the general idea for this evening is sort of a bit more kind of interaction based, and we'll kind of go over some of the source material, why it's important, and sort of take kind of questions more possibly from myself in regards to the fact that it is for the most part my own reading, and it's me that kind of has linked some of it, so.
Yeah, you're really who we kind of nicked a lot of this stuff off, or at least you're essentially our researcher.
Yeah.
that's kind of how I'd introduce you, really, is a researcher. I don't know how else to put it, really, but you are going to be present on next week's stream as well.
Yes.
Yeah, you will be talking about Keynesianism, since you're the economist here, really.
Yeah. So soon to be graduate economist.
Yes, soon to be graduate. Yes, soon. Soon. But how did this? I think this show was my idea. I can't tell at this point anymore.
I don't know. All the discussions I think for the original ideas probably happened in person anyway, so at the
Yeah, they
very
did.
least we'll cut it 50-50, but I don't think it would have happened without me having read a large amount of the stuff that I have.
No, you are like a human reference library.
Kind of for this specific realm of like material in regards to a lot of Austrian stuff and sort of anarchist and libertarian literature, I do have quite a lot of it stored in the back of my head for some reason.
Yeah, it's a bit of an odd one, but it's a good skill to have, I guess. It's not the worst thing. I guess you could have like me still have like a residual encyclopedic knowledge of all the Pokemon from when I was about 10. So
God, yeah, I would much rather have great materials such as An Austrian yeah. Perspective of the History of Economic Thought by Rothbard in both Volume 1 and Volume 2 in the back of my mind.
I receive the History of Austrian Economics. You receive the PokéRap.
Well, no, I think actually in part that might have been part of what drove the discussion was us ending up discussing some of the early stuff from, again, the Rothbard's History of Economic Thought that I've just referenced there, as that was sort of one of the few materials that touches heavily on the ideas of sort of, what would be the phrase? God, you talked about it at length at one point, now I can't remember the word for it. Utilitarianism,
empiricism,
which is a big precursor to a lot of the universalism that you would need to then, you know, underwrite democracy with it. There is no democracy without universalism.
That is a good, yeah, that's the point. And it's very Leonard Nimoy, needs of the many, needs of the few kind of stuff. It's very, very surface level midwit ethics.
Yes, but underwritten within that is the justification for basically all sort of statist evil and absolute power in a certain sense, because we are the people who define what is and what isn't good, and ergo, you know, via our hegemony, we shall further consolidate our own power.
Yep. Well, like I said, we need to draw a line somewhere. There's so much, like, you could just go back to, like, when man picks up the stick with the monolith and
yeah,
the bone.
Yeah, but sharpens stick, 2,000 years panopticon, why would sharp sticks do this to us?
Oh, God, yeah. It's the people standing on the legged lungfish. You motherfucker. That motherfucker right there. It's the lungfish.
Get back in the water.
Mm. Return to the water, you bastard. Yeah, it's kind of a lighter stream today, I guess. We really want to go over some of like the reading and the source material, since a lot of you have engaged with this quite heavily, but I kind of feel sorry for some people that don't have the reference points, because a lot of this is very heavy reading. Actually, this stems from a conversation I had with Rose of Dawn last night on her stream, where she said she was trying to read Leviathan and its enemies without a lot of the other informing and underpinning stuff, which is a feat in of itself, even for someone like me who is you know, a magpie of a lot of this reading.
Well, I think the fact that you have me to sort of verify each sort of position of understanding of in regards to that stuff, that sort of, I don't know, you have someone that has read a lot of the material there to verify with, so I think you can be confident in the fact that you can actually grasp some of it, whereas some people in a sort of situation whereby if, you know, they've only ever read a bit of Milton Friedman or a bit of Locke, or, you know, they've not
got into... Did you read Loki?
They've not got into very heavy applied political theory, that sometimes it's not necessarily that they don't grasp it, but they don't understand the weight, really, of what is being said.
That is also true, yes.
Because I think especially as the sort of picture of it is there, Leviathan and its enemies, even though it's maybe not, it's not the core material of the streams, it is one of the sort of singular pieces of literature on its own that gets as close to what we are sort of seeing with the stuff that we've done. I mean, if we could get right into sort of what I've been discussing with a few people and trying to come up with in my own sort of form, is essentially a sort of notion of post-Marxism, if you will. And, you know, this is ultimately kind of the position where Francis sits in, along with Hopper as well, and that they both have come to a sort of realisation that you can use the Marxist understanding of class analysis and turn it on its head so that you're no longer railing at monopoly capitalism in the form of the capitalists, you're railing at monopoly capitalism in the form of the statists that enable it. It's true, though. It's entirely true. I mean, the total state would not exist without statists. They must believe in it and they must justify it.
Well, there's also something as well that even if you're not someone who's you know, interested in quote unquote anarchism, to be able to criticize the state, I think you need a framework.
You need to be able to step entirely outside of it.
You need a moral framework in which the state isn't acting, or in which state action isn't the only moral action.
To critique the state with some sort of other philosophy that ultimately justifies a state is defeating the point of your critique.
Yes. Yes, it is. But to get a little bit into some of the actual stuff we'll be covering today, before you get too much into the weeds, one of the reasons I'm interested in this as well is the fact that... there is actually quite comprehensive reference material that I've set up for all these streams. Unfortunately, YouTube actually makes it go a bit dodgy. If I click, there's like weird gaps, even though they're not there in the original document. And I would go back in and edit it, but when you go back in and edit a community post like this, it balks all the links.
Ugh,
so it's not it's all here. It's not the best, but it is there. I'm thinking of actually finding a way to link some of the show notes, really. Because I'm trying to keep it within the same ecosystem here, so there isn't too much clicking.
That might be something. It's worth like making a wee dedicated sort of Substack page or something for the stream notes, and then publishing them in a slightly prettier kind of form.
That's probably a good idea, but like I said, it's the problem is you get diminishing returns, and also the amount of click-throughs diminishes the amount of people who actually get to the content.
This is true,
Trying to keep it in the same ecosystem. Pins to each of the democratization videos is a comment that contains the references. I'm trying to make sure I edit it into the description of a lot of them, but the descriptions tend to be a bit busy with all the shilling links, basically, and where you can find those on the platforms, so it might get a bit buried there, so it's in both in quite a few places. And it's also if you just click on the community tab as well. But those of you who are interested in reading around the subjects and verifying our sources, because I do want you guys to come in really and fact check us. That is something that needs to be done. Can there be a state without? Yeah, it's always the roads, isn't it?
If there's no state, who's going to vaccinate the roads?
Yes. Who will transition the bridges? Yes.
There is too many bridges. There must be more tunnels for the sake of diversity.
But they are all there in the community tab. But most of what we nick stuff off really is the Mises Institute.
Well, it's more the fact that they are based enough to essentially have all the material sourced on there as a sort of bit of an archive. So it's you know, because I mean, I think most of the long form texts we are referencing that are on there are actually written prior to the institution of the Mises Institute.
Oh, of course, yeah.
I think the second, sorry, the first volume of Rothbard's History of Economic Thought was written before it. I think the second one might have been written during its creation, but that was also sort of round about the time of Rothbard's death, which is why it sort of finishes just at classical economics, because if I'm right in saying there is a transcript for part of what was supposed to be the third volume out there that exists, that it never really got finished and was meant to lead right up through to Keynesianism and also possibly even an MMT, which is something that might become a bit more sort of useful next week.
Yes, I think that would be. From my point of view, I like a lot of these sources, and they do touch on UK stuff enough for the purposes of the stream. But
the issue kind of with the Rothbard stuff is that he stops looking at the UK roughly like, you know, after the billionist anti-billionist sort of debate around very early Bank of England stuff. It's very interesting. It's got a great thing to look at because it sort of shows how the true nature of the gold standard was kind of peeled back as early as the mid-1700s, but after that, it's not really something he takes much stock on. However, it's a fantastic analysis of where some of the original ideas for the modern total democratic state come from and how they evolve and pass over time. Even though it's ultimately about economic thought, the way in which economics underwrites so much of the organisation of society and sort of precedes and necessitates a total state and a sort of kind of reciprocal nature, and that both economic thought in a certain form and the nature of the state in a certain form feed back on each other.
It's very interesting. I don't know, it's great because Rothbard also brings in certain elements of political history. He's I like the Austrian school stuff as well because they're not shy of having a lot of context there.
Yeah, I mean, there's a big dilemma, and again, these books is the Catholic Protestant split, and I think that was a thing you partly touched on in the first episode, is, you know, Protestant determinism and how without that you would not have Hegel.
No.
And how, you know, the Anabaptist sort of absolutists of the early Calvinist and Lutheran era are actually, you know, communists that predate communism and are a perfect sort of example of what Hegel wanted prior really to Hegel writing in any way, shape or form. It's quite funny.
It's interesting that, like, the fertile ground was there, really, and all they really did was take advantage of it. Like, if you look at someone like Bentham, and what he did, where he basically pretended to be a Protestant for a while, or at least he couched things in their terms, and that's really where you get the worst excesses of, you know, the Panopticon we talk about, and we'll be talking about continuously quite heavily, and all those ideas of utilitarianism, and in basically him creating what were essentially disciples out of a religious idea he didn't actually believe in. He believed in utilitarianism. You know, he couched it in religious terms, like we talked about it, but he wasn't a religious man himself.
Yeah, he didn't believe in anything above the material good to any way, shape, or form. Even if you take him at face value, there is nothing higher than, you know, the greater good. The greater good.
That's a meme in of itself, but yeah, it's an Austrian perspective, and I can make thought. It's a big book.
It's two big 500-page books. However, it's... After, I don't know where I would put it, really. It's if you're someone who has read something like Human Action or, you know, a decent amount of Rothbard, it's worth having a kind of delve into because there is so much interest and stuff in there. I mean, I'd imagine a few of the people who are watching this are at least aware of Stephen Carson or Radlib, as he goes by. This is a book that he recommended and that I picked up on after that because, quite frankly, his book recommendations are even better than mine, believe it or not.
Really?
And yeah, no, I mean, he described it as a book that was like a page turner, and I thought there's no way like 1,000 pages worth of economic thought history could be a page turner. But as you said it yourself, the way he pulls in so much contextual stuff,
it's very compelling,
that you find yourself, oh well, how does this idea follow on, or where does this individual end up, or, you know, what effects happen because of the application of this policy?
In contrast to a lot of leftist theory that I've had to read to understand it, and a lot of what I would consider like modern canon of economics and politics, like, and not to ruin the next week's stream, but Keynesianism, the writing about it doesn't make any fucking sense. It's not compelling.
Yes, well, that's because it's not supposed to make sense to the normies. It only makes sense to those who are looking to really derive some sort of political change or power, ultimately, through
it.
You know, that is part of the thing, again, why Francis is so important in regards to this series, is he says a lot of the same sort of things as other individuals, but because he is underwritten in this sort of frame of post-Marxism, there is a power analysis underwritten within it, and that each sort of statement he is sort of putting forward is not just that, you know, these people believed in X policy and Y happened. It is these people believed in X policy, Y happened, and this allowed them to further consolidate or become the new emergence of elites. You know, it's not just political theory, it's political theory with elite theory underwritten within it.
It's, again, a lot of it's very alien to, I don't know, quite a few people. It's not their fault because most people haven't been taught it in any way, shape, or form.
It's supposed to be alien. It's supposed to obfuscate and really dissuade you from the genuine reality of what's happening in any situation. I mean, as it's something that will be mentioned again next week, but... Oh, pardon me. The need for so much of this complex theory and sort of complex philosophy is that it keeps you distracted or away from the, you know, or detached from the true purpose of sort of your own ability to change the world around you in a certain sense.
Yeah. Yeah, yes, it very much does. And, like, it's amazing how simple and how compelling a lot of the, like I said, the Austrian school stuff is. It is just readable. It's if you have any grasp on economic or political theory, outside of the cathedral, if you are at least curious as to, you know, what people think who aren't Keynesians.
Yeah, it's almost like a great de-education tool.
Yes, it is. it's pretty exceptional. It's deprogramming, really.
Mm.
And that's something I've tried to pitch in another sense to people, that there's a lot of stuff here that, unless you've been paying attention, unless you've directly tried to row back on the myths of history, you know, even if you're someone who has done that actively, you may have missed a lot of this, because there's so much of it is a framework of lies, and it's very, very provably a framework of lies. And outside of the left-wing revisionists, again, we'll get onto a little bit of that when we talk about Betrayal of the Right by Rothbard, because Rothbard really is, he's a great combination of readable but also extremely up on theory. Mm. It's Rothbard and Hopper in some ways as well, but those two really, in my opinion, if you understand a lot of the basics of Austrian economics, those two are the most readable,
yeah,
and the most kind
of
page-turner.
Maybe it would be briefly worth mentioning for those who are sort of entirely unaware of, what would be the phrase, you know, non-mainstream or non, you know, heterodox economic thought, that the place to go is, one, the Mises Institute, and a book by Henry Hazlitt called Economics in One Lesson, which is a fantastic sort of small treatise that very much plays on the ideas of Bastiat and a number of other sort of proto-Austrian figures whose insights are very eloquently sort of displayed, and not necessarily the fullest form. You would not get the same sort of depth of knowledge out of this that you would within, say, for example, you know, a full work by Mises or Rothbard, but as a primer for all that stuff, if you haven't engaged in any economics prior to it, it is the place to go as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, there's actually a free copy on, I think it's the Economic Education guys who do it.
Yeah.
Foundation for Economic Education has a free PDF of Henry Hazlitt's.
I mean, if you actually live in America, you can email the Mises Institute. And if you and a number of people are looking to engage in economics of learning, they will actually send you copies. I know they were doing this for a while. I don't know if they're doing it anymore, because I'll be honest, I'm someone who, I struggle with PDFs. It kind of needs to be a physical book for me.
Oh, we actually had a donation about 10 minutes ago. I didn't see that. The Base Night Guide has donated $14.88. Very subtle there. Do you want to read that one?
I shouldn't be surprised. GG has been doing a lot of research for this great series. Behind every great man is a great trap. Ludwig von Yee-ass haircut. I mean, there's not a word of that I'd be willing to refute. Thank you.
thank you for the memes. The memes will set us free. It's Austrian economics plus memes over
memes
here.
Macht frei.
Yeah, memes macht frei. I don't know. Do you want to talk about human action at all? Or
I think that's maybe something we can sort of work towards. What I was actually going to suggest was that, you know, as I sort of mentioned, the Rothbard's History of Econ is very, it's underwritten a lot by religious thinking. And that sort of notion, once you have read a few of the works, is really heavily portrayed in a book called Liberty or Equality by, oh god, is Eric von Kuhnelt-Leden or whatever.
Yeah.
It's as good as I can get for this.
Is that the Liberty or Equality
yes,
one?
Yes, it is. It's the challenge of our time, which is a great sort of literature-based perspective on a lot of the same argumentation that Hopper gives in regards to political theory. And if you're anyone that has read Democracy, the God That Failed, and you're chomping at the bit for more of the same sort of powerful rhetoric in regards, or so, shall we say, chomping at the bit for powerful rhetoric to add to that theory, that is the book as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, that's what we read from during the Consequences of World War One stream, when we basically did like the five or six combination punch against democracy.
Oh, because it's so damning. I mean, you've got, I think, is it?
I think we went like Mises, Rothbard, Hopper, Francis,
I think one of my favourite parts out of it was, is it something, somebody Sarwell or something like that, who was like an English lord or something like that in the late 17th and early 1800s, and he's discussing the way that, you know, the British Empire is moving into China, and he describes that, you know, us going to China and depurifying them via, universalism and the ideas of oh God, I keep forgetting the phrase.
Utilitarianism.
The utilitarianism is essentially a shame on the white race. It's so based. It's unbelievably
based.
Well,
it is extremely based. It's a lot of people will go back and forth about, the British Empire and colonization, but
it's really the ideas we spread. That was the real cancer.
Well, it's not just the ideas of colonization are the same ideas of total state and total economics.
Yes.
They are the same ideas.
Yes, the total state and imperialism go hand in hand. And the fact that, leftists call capitalism imperialism is, again, it's the Marxist notion. But as soon as you flip it on its head and you realise it's not monopoly capitalism, it's the monopoly of force via the total state is the real issue. It then becomes so obvious. I mean, you could almost go to the realms of saying that there is a Hoppe is like some sort of, he's even almost like a post-Trotskyist or something like that.
Yeah, it's that a lot of people think a lot of, again, I was on British Knights channel, thank you for watching, I see you there in the chat, a couple of days ago, talking about the fact that there's a huge amount of people who are on the quote-unquote right who don't like the idea of adapting leftist rhetoric, ideas, and especially like class and power dialectics.
Yes.
To, having useful tactics on the right. And I think that's, frankly retarded. That you shouldn't say that certain ideas, certain viewpoints, certain phrases, and even certain tactics at the moment are verboten.
Which is entirely sort of fallacious, because clearly, not to dwell on lots of contemporary stuff when we're here to talk about certain types of literature, the left nowadays has no rules of engagement. So no. Why should we be the same? I mean, as I discussed on AA's stream the other night, the ideas of Lenin in regards to tactics is where the right needs to be nowadays.
It's like a Hoppe and Snake meme. It's the rights are reciprocated.
Yes, principle doesn't exist when other people don't believe in it.
No. If you have someone who does not regard you as human, you can't regard them as human if they're taking action against you.
Yeah, and it circulates back round to the, again, a lot of the notions in liberty or equality, which is that democracy is ultimately it is a faith to a certain extent, or shall we say almost a lack of faith in your fellow man, that you almost demand some sort of large, overarching sort of superstructure so that everyone must be responsible, because you do not believe that people are capable of being responsible themselves, unlike our snake friend here.
Snake friend. He will not be tread on, for he is reading Hoppe, and he understands.
I know snip on you, Mr.
Snake. I know snip on you, Mr. Snake, yes. Oh, dear. But you did mention Leviathan earlier, and I think that's, honestly, it's the closest piece of literature I can think of to what the series is trying to do, because it's such a magpie in a good way.
Yes.
And it has such specific language in it as well.
But it is underwritten with, Sam Francis deliberately uses all the rhetoric of Marx.
Yes.
And he gets that directly from Burnham. That being James Burnham, I think, who you have mentioned and sourced already somewhat.
We've not sourced him directly. We've mentioned his ideas, but we've kind of sourced managerialism through Francis, which is, I think, the way to do it. We will be quoting from Burnham's Machiavellians at some point, I think. I've got a good quote from there.
That is something I do need to actually get around to reading at some point, but again, it's something I'd rather get as a physical copy.
Yeah, and the Managerial Revolution, I've got some quotes out of that too. And then, later on, maybe if we do get into the 1950s, we can talk about Suicide of the West, which is
Suicide of the West is the thing that got him kicked out of the paleocon movement, because he began to understand to a certain extent that focusing the minds of the average person on faraway combat and, the myth of the nation state as used as a powerful, sort of force for not necessarily change in any way, shape or form, but essentially what would the phrase be? He recognises that this is almost an evil force, and that the thing he kind of looked up to in a large part, even though he used to be a bit of a war hawk, was the very thing to a certain extent that was driving things in the wrong direction.
Yeah, it's, well, the problem is that The right likes to say that it has, you know, an open door and it's very free speech based.
It's just as cliquey and as bad as the left. It's just the fact that they keep it quieter.
Yeah, once you start talking about the Forever Wars, yeah, you will get kicked out of the right so fucking fast.
Mm. I mean, that's the reason why Buckley and characters like, who's the other Chicago school guy? Buchanan.
Yeah.
I mean, even though they were technically quite radical and technically quite libertarian, they believed in two things, which was ultimately the justification of the total state and the necessity of engaging in foreign wars to keep things going in a certain sense because it further consolidated power.
Sorry, I've just gone a little bit behind this. I'm just going to open the door a little bit here. It's getting a bit stuffy for me. I'm an old man. And I need my fresh airs. So that's if you heard any background noise, that's what that was. But no, he's a great case study. It's also kind of like, again, that kind of neatly leads into, where's it gone? The Betrayal of the American Right, which is one, yeah, I've read and you actually haven't.
Yeah, I haven't got that. The thing is, I want to just address the point that Yiz is making there in the chat. I know exactly who she's talking about and I do understand the point, but the thing that Francis identifies so well and that Burnham started to really identify was that it was never the people, it was always the power structure that you were up against.
Yes.
You know, you are not up against Bush, you are not up against Cheney, you are not up against Clinton. You're up against the total state. You know, the cathedral as it's referred to in NRX circles.
Oh, you know, the Leviathan as it's referred to directly there.
Yes.
It's the, I, you know, there are some free versions of it. You've got a physical copy that I have, you know, has been very good in informing this, because the version that's on archive.org here of Leviathan and its enemies is an EPUB rip, and it's not a particularly good one. Mm. And it does download as a PDF, but it doesn't have an index, and it also doesn't have the same page numbering as the real version does, so it can be a bitch to get references out of. But luckily we've got a physical copy here we can reference, so...
Yeah, it's a book that you do need to fork out. I think it was £36 or something like that, but it's a very nice, well-bound, hardback book. It's the sort of thing that's worth keeping.
We have a couple more donations here. Thank you, Skullhammer, for donating. I don't have the Streamlabs widget working. I didn't have time for that. It was being a bit finicky with me. So they're not popping up on screen today, since I'm the stream pusher and not Trig. But I'm still trying to make sure to read them, so there's no default zombie today, I'm afraid. But yeah, says, this is for Trig to go towards a pair of new gloves. I'm not sure what that's in reference to, I'm sure it's a reference. And HK9410 with the $50 there, thank you very much. It's been wonderful watching the streams, especially with the source material. Keep up the good work. Also, I paid off my car last week, so I have some extra share. Thank you very much, that's a big donation, wow. I'll try and make sure some of that makes its way to you as well.
That would be appreciated.
Yeah,
no longer is my labour being exploited, so I'll continue to be a post-Marxist and not a standard Marxist.
No, we do need to get some stuff up there.
Every single little hat is a villain. I understand you weren't making a sort of specific point, but I do like that little phrase in there, the little hats.
The little hats is a good one.
So you were about to go on to, is it Rothbard's Betrayal of the Right?
Yeah.
Is that introduction by Thomas E. Woods? Ooh, it might be worth just reading for that.
I think there's like four or five intros to it, because there's an intro for each edition.
Right. Is there, because, well, you'd be able to tell me, is there a lot of Mencken's stuff referenced in this?
I think there's a bit of it referenced.
Mencken is, if I'm right in saying, was a journalist about the sort of 20s, 30s, 40s and 50s, and he's someone who probably has a lot of great stuff to say about what we've been doing so far.
There's a little bit. There's not... I don't remember there being a huge amount of Mencken.
But it's not something I've delved into just yet, but it's one of those people that if you are really in the know in regards to a lot of the Austrian school stuff, because he's referenced a lot of Mises' work and Hopper's work.
The main thing I find in the Betrayal of the American Right, really, there's a lot of very specific stuff that's slightly outdated, honestly, because it was written in 1979. Well, it was written in the 70s and throughout the 70s.
Well, I mean, Burnham's stuff was written from, what, the 40s, right?
Oh, no,
the 60s?
He has some quite specific stuff about the mood of the nation and Vietnam and stuff like that, which is good. It's a good period. It's a good a kind of window into the period, but some of the best stuff, I think, is about how the American right just morphed into this, you know, closed society of war hawks, like he talks about.
Yeah, he basically talks about the formation of the modern neocon movement. I mean, yes. I think if you were to do the progressive era, then the betrayal of the American right is a series of books. It would become so glaringly obvious to you to see all the problems in the modern right.
Yeah, it's a great elucidation of that. And he also really brings in the fact that he almost got drawn into the trap of listening to left revisionists.
Mm.
In fact, he did get drawn in for a while.
It's because that was the only people that would agree with him in the Vietnam War stuff. And that's why prior to this, he wrote a series of articles around the phrase, I believe it was a farewell to the left.
Yes.
Within which he actually references Lenin and all sorts of strange characters, and is actually is a very good piece on political theory. I think one of the quotes from it is something along the lines of, like, once you are mixing with those who are not in your in-group, you must be entirely steadfast in principle, but ultimately varying in strategy.
Which is a very good point to make, in that there's a lot of mixed in stuff there as well, about kind of entryism and the fact that the left, you know, eventually gets the fact that the left will enter movements and essentially undermine them. It's funny him talking about Lenin like that, because there's something I want to bring up, not obviously next week is the Keynesianism stuff, but after that we're doing the totalitarian stuff, and it's to do with, like, oh, what is it called? It's the way, it's Soviet democracy, basically, is a way of stopping the endless debates that the left impose on everyone else. Because within their own in-groups, some of the, especially the top level of their circles, they know that you must have absolute dominance of the debate to an extreme degree.
Yes, and something like the will of the people, or the consent of the people, or the consent of the governed, is like one of the highest sort of echelons of argument that you could make.
Mm.
And I think I would imagine, in a certain sense, the betrayal of the American right in the most sort of short form would essentially be Rothbard saying that that sort of principle from Lenin about, you know, staying hard on principles but varying on tactics is the exact opposite of what the modern American right has done.
Yes.
They've entirely varied on principles and stayed stagnant on tactics.
Well, it's like, again, it's like I keep talking about, during the series and during the series so far, we've talked very little about Republican leaders and British Conservative leaders, because they're basically empty suits.
Yeah, they're inconsequential.
Yeah. They are caretakers who let the institutions around them run roughshod whilst they pretend to make reforms.
Yeah, they inherit Leviathan from the left and then keep up the illusion that they're going to do something about it, but every time they inherit it, it's like, oh well, because of the nature of the structure of the beast, we can't really do anything, because even though we have the will of the people, there is X, Y, and Z institutional, or, you know, separation of powers sort of forces that stop them. And it's, you know, it's understanding things like the separation of the powers actually being a way to consolidate power, not take power away. There's really the level you've got to get on to really gain the value out of a lot of this writing.
Yeah, it's a lot of the quote-unquote limits on democracy and controls on pure populism and controls on, you know, the tyranny of the majority are really there to stop anyone from making any change to the system.
Yeah.
through the levers of power, you know, through the democratic levers that are supposed to be there. You know, if what you vote for isn't in agreement with the elites already, it will not be implemented, and it can't be implemented. And what happens is you end up with the process of, you know, every time something that is, you know, voted for and given democratic permission, quote-unquote, from the populace that lines up with the elites, every time it lines up, it gets implemented, and everything that doesn't line up doesn't get implemented. And that process just continues. And then you get the whole thing of, well, you know, they instituted half of their the popular things they wanted and half of their manifesto, but, you know, we'll try again next time. Give them the next round. Yeah, if you read Progressive Era, then Betrayal of the American Right, and, you know, I've not actually read Goodbye to the Left. I thought I had, I haven't.
That's quite a short one. I think that's literally just an essay or two.
Yes, I've heard of it. I haven't actually read it. That is worth reading, and all of that will really... A lot of people think they can solve this by being a conservative, and, you know, well, we just need to become more paleo-conservative.
We just need to reform the entity, which you just cannot do. It is designed to be unreformable.
Well, it's... A lot of people have become, you know, wise to the fact that conservatism is just leftism with a speed limit.
Yes, which and thought it, was, I think, the phrase from Malice. But however, I think he probably gets that from somewhere else.
Yeah. There's a bunch of stuff we're not talking about here source-wise either that we will be bringing in later. How much of Soul have you read?
I've listened to a lot of Soul's lectures, and I have gained a lot of knowledge from Soul via second-hand stuff. However, as much as some of it's a good gateway, I would much rather people went the Hazlitt route and then into Rothbard, Mises and Hopper, because Soul has some great stuff and he has some great rhetoric, and some of his specific things on policy are all right, but I think he ultimately is not something you could take and use as part of a revolutionary framework, which is sort of where this is all going to end up at some point, really, with the stuff that we were discussing, is that hegemony cannot be reformed.
No.
There is no amount of efficiency you can apply to it, which is ultimately what the Chicago School, which Soul was a part of, wanted to do. They never wanted to, you know, change the nature of the beast. They just wanted to make it more efficient, which to a certain extent is worse.
I think he has a lot of ideas that are very useful as an on-ramp.
Yes, but I would rather people didn't have to unlearn the issues of Soul. I think it's better to come back retrospectively to Soul for some different insights on
Well, that's what we're kind of doing here. And that's what we're kind of doing with the series, is I don't want to bring in Soul first, because then you have to untangle a lot of the stuff that's kind of wrong with that.
Yeah.
I want to bring in, I think his best contribution really is the constrained and unconstrained vision stuff and the vision of the anointed stuff.
Yes, that is a useful aspect in regards to philosophy. That is a useful insight. That is something that is ultimately expressed in the most sort of guttural form, and possibly something we could go on to discuss about now, which is a lot of Mises' work. And
yes.
The formulation of praxeology, as he describes it, within human action, which is, you know, as far as I'm concerned, if you want to become someone who is deeply engrossed in Austrian economics, it is the book you must read.
Human Action is a very dense tome. I've not read it all myself. I've read sections of it. But it is very good.
Well, no, it's possibly one of the most sort of useful political economics sort of treaties that has been written in a very long time. It doesn't slack in a lot of areas, and once you have come to grips with both Hopper and Rothbard, when you go and look back on it, you can see it all within there. I mean, even Hopper's ethics argumentation, which is something that I don't know whether or not anyone that's listening is going to grasp to any great degree, the nature of that is within Mises' writing, and once you grasp what it is, you can read it right out of Mises, and it gives you so much more of it than what you originally got. I mean, it is a book that I would actually consider at some point reading again.
A lot of this stuff is just great reference material too.
Mm.
It's, you know, all of these have indexes in them, and you can just look up any issue that you want to, you know, if you want to kind of hop around in the books a bit. Yeah, hopper. You want to hopper around the books a bit? That's what we've been doing, really, to try and find some good quotes for the stuff that we've been covering. It's what I've done when I've tried to find a lot of the stuff about democracy, and quite literally mentioning democratization a couple of times, like Francis does.
I think Francis, Hopper, and also Sutton, and also Eric von Ritter, Kleineld, Leiden, or whatever his name is.
Yes, hopper around. space. There's some sort of like space hopper joke there.
Like a big inflatable sort of head of Hopper with the two sort of pointy bits on the head.
Yeah. It's two bananas.
I have this banana. I give you this banana. I'm warning you about this banana. I'm telling you to get rid of this banana.
No, Human Action is a great reference one. Like I said, it's dense to get into a lot of this stuff. If you're not familiar with like the Austrian School of Economics or like an Austrian view of history,
it's not even that it's just sort of dense theory wise. Mises is also like an entire fucking show off in regards to his language.
Well, there's also the issue as well that it is a translation from German. I know he had control over the translation, but it's still
I find it quite eloquent, I'll be honest.
It is very eloquent, but some of the phrasing can be a bit bit unfamiliar to people.
Yes.
Especially if you're not particularly familiar with a lot of academic language. But then again, I don't think a lot of people who actually watch these would be unfamiliar with academic language. There's a bit of a filter here in terms of people's reading level. Because I think anyone who is maybe under a certain level of intelligence would watch this stream and just kind of go, huh? I'm sorry, guys, but this does kind of filter out the midwits a bit.
Yes, I've essentially enforced a level of gatekeeping upon everyone by the sources that I've applied.
I don't know. It could just be me and Trig just talking off the top of our heads for 3 hours, just going, hey, guys, did you know that democracy is bad?
Do you know that the feminists are bad?
Hey, do you guys know that the feminists like democracy? So democracy must be bad? No, we are trying to get a good underpinning of theory here, along with our own
Which is why you should be privileged to a certain extent by us doing this stream, because it's, I don't know, I'm hoping possibly at some point people in chat might sort of, I don't know, chime in with any things that they are curious about in regards to some of the material as we kind of work through and discuss some of it.
Yeah, feel free to ask some questions. I'm sure we'll get some questions in the comments on this one, since most people seem to watch the VODs of these. Like I said, you don't just have to donate to get questions answered. We do read the chat, as you've seen. But I don't know, what is another piece of reading material? Because we've talked about Rothbard, well, talked about Mises. Do you want to talk about any Hopper?
Well, that's what I was about to suggest. Actually, you know, one of the brilliant ones from, I was aware of Democracy, the God That Failed before I read Human Action. Yeah. I hadn't read it in full prior to that, but at one point Mises literally states word for word the whole argument underlying Democracy, the God That Failed, which is that once the populace understands that via democracy they can vote to enrich themselves,
yes,
then you functionally live in something that is essentially socialism. If your property is at the whim of the state, and the whim of the state is either, you know, in theory or not, yeah, something that can be decided on by the masses via the tyranny of the majority via democracy, whether it's actually the democratic opinion or not, at the end of the day, your property is being pilfered. And it will be pilfered at whatever rate is required to keep the current elites in power.
If you like spicy stuff, Hopper's pretty good. But there is, it's not an issue, but a lot of people just inherently get it, and Hopper's good for those people. But he also builds on a lot of the stuff from Mises and Rothbard.
Well, it's not just the, I think that, you know, it's all very well and good to get the general argument of the, oh yes, people vote to enrich themselves and you essentially live in socialism. There is so much nuance in the way that you can go about describing the process.
Yeah.
I mean, what Hopper does a lot of the times is something that I've started doing kind of my own writing, which is you make a point and then you kind of say it, you kind of say the same thing 3 or 4 times, but functionally describe it slightly different. And what it does is it really gets to the core of what is for all Austrian economics the core point, which is studying causal analysis. You know, it is the causal relationships that sort of make the building blocks for that argument of, you know, once people vote to enrich themselves, you essentially live in socialism.
Well, the best thing about this is that all of this stuff interlocks extremely well.
Yeah.
It hangs together extremely well.
Well, it's all predicated upon praxeology and systems of logic, and there is no need in a certain sense for you to have a theoretical position on your way in.
Yeah.
Whereas if you were to read a lot of literature based around Marxism, you would have to understand Marx.
It's not even just that. A lot of literature surrounding Marxism or supposed bastions of the modern left, a lot of it is, it's not got an internal logic to it. Marx does, and some of the more clever Marxists do, but a lot of the literature around Marx, not the literature that leftists will recommend to people, is very much at odds with itself.
Yes.
And doesn't have the same logical implication, doesn't even have the same worldview in many cases.
It's something, again, that's commented on by Hopper, is that on a very high level, all argumentation must follow a logical structure.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it is in some level self-defeating. I mean, the underlying principle of all Marxism that, you know, any form of private property is theft is a is a statement that refutes itself, because you must invoke the ideal of property. You know, if property is immoral, then what? How is stealing from you immoral? Because you're not supposed to own something. You know, you cannot own, or sorry, you cannot have stolen from you that which you do not own.
There's a lot of like apologetics that go on. It's, you get a lot of people who try and go into like the social democrat framework, but try and squish Marxism into that, and Marxism just doesn't fit.
Well, because Marxism is a predecessor of that stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, you being a social democrat is you essentially admitting defeat to the hegemony that exists nowadays. I mean, the thing I have started to grasp from a lot of Hoppe's work and a lot of stuff that I can sort of synthesize along with it is that by the nature of both Marxism and Leninism, you live in a state whereby your property rights are not absolute. And due to the nature of democracy, all political strategies in some way, shape or form must be collectivist. And that the most pure form of collectivism in a strategical sense is Leninism.
Yes.
You know, to a certain extent, you have to let those things sort of inform your political thought nowadays. And when you realise these and look backwards through figures like FDR and even Hitler to some extent, you begin to realise that those figures were all in a certain sense like radical centrists. All they did was take radical sort of energy that had a, you know, a Leninist style Bolshevik rhetoric to it that was absolutist, and that created the illusion of a consensus. And they squeezed all these different consensuses together so that they could consolidate it under themselves and they could be the boot.
It is, a lot of it is just justification, especially when you try and... There is a pure, quote-unquote, Marxist framework that could hang together, but people don't use it because it falls apart. A lot of people try and work around what Marx said, rather than trying to actually work through it as a logical worldview.
Well, that's the work we mentioned before, the second volume of Rothbard's History of Economics. It discusses at length all of the questions and contemporary sort of essays and stuff that were sent to Marx and each of his derivations of the volumes of Das Kapital.
Yeah.
And like, I think at one point he sort of almost comically goes over this whole saga of Bombeverk's first sort of elucidation of pure time preference theory in regards to labour.
Yeah.
And that he writes for decades around this issue and takes the whole labour theory of value and just changes the words, but never functionally changes the argument.
The thing that appeals to me most on a philosophical level with kind of Mises, Rothbard, Hopper and all those people is that it is an ethical framework and a framework for human interaction that is not predicated on coercion.
No, well, that's the whole underwriting of economics in regards to the Austrian school, is that if any economic interaction that you stipulate must be precedent by some form of coercion or some form of force, then you are no longer really engaging at all in economics.
Well, it's the idea of, I don't know how you can see someone as dangerous when their worldview is, I want to be left alone and I believe you should be left alone.
Because that ultimately is a sort of attack against people's structure of support and safety.
It is. Well, to them it is, yeah, because they've become kind of clients of the system. They've become Agent Smith, as you like to say. And that's true, but that is an admission, really, that their framework is predicated on, you know, to use Marxist terms, exploiting your labour.
Yeah.
It's quite funny. You can really phrase it in those kind of class dialectics and say, well, okay, you know, in this framework, you are the employer, you are the bourgeois, and I am the proletariat.
Yeah, I mean, politicians and those that work for, you know, public infrastructure, they ultimately extract value from our time and our energy.
Yes.
We would be doing, you know, things other than what we are forced to do via those mechanisms. And that, you know, again, that it could all be seen as a form of Marxism flipped on its head, and it becomes so obvious to me through that.
Here's a book you're currently reading to go into more Hoppe, The Great Fiction.
Yeah.
You're about halfway through it, three quarters maybe?
Maybe two thirds at most.
Yeah.
it's quite a dense work. It's one that I wouldn't really recommend unless you are really sort of, especially in the latter half, familiar with the very sort of intricacies of the Austrian method. I mean, the section in the middle of, in regards to methodology and epistemological stuff to do with certainty and uncertainty and approaching, I think, what is it refers to? Is it hermeneutics? Which is like a version of the Austrian school whereby they suggest that there is no available version of certainty and all this kind of stuff, is even to a certain extent kind of above my level and something that I might need to go back through to really grasp a lot of the insights out of. But it is a very good work, and it is a sort of great thing that the Mises Institute has made available what is a book that used to be hundreds and hundreds of pounds and only available on very esoteric sites.
Yes, that's one of the main reasons we use the Mises Institute so much for these streams, is because, ironically, they're much better than the Marxists at disseminating useful sources without cost. Yeah. It's quite funny.
No, there is a great irony to it in regards to the fact that via Austrian economics and the insights of psychic profit, one is so much greater at charity as a capitalist than they are as a socialist.
Yes, it is. It's they are much more efficient at actually disseminating what they really believe.
Because I would say if there's one other thing than the stream that you should consider throwing your money at, it is the Mises Institute. I mean, I say this with no hint of irony, but as long as the Mises Institute exists, there is still hope, as far as I'm concerned.
It's something I've actually encountered repeatedly without, like, way before any of this. I'd often kind of just come across their articles when I was searching for a certain subject. There's certain combinations of very anti-establishment keywords that will bring you a page of Mises Institute stuff and nothing else.
Because it's almost like, to a certain extent, I used to, when I was doing all my economics work for uni, I would just look up whatever subject I was doing.
Yeah.
Even if, like, it was the Mises dudes, as I like to refer to them, were giving, you know, a very plain description of, like, the public goods theory, I would use their version of it, because underwritten within it would be some sort of cheeky wee point about, like, oh, you know, X, Y, or Z doesn't really work, and I would slide that under the door, kind of. There is a great article by Rothbard on property rights and pollution, which if anyone ever brings up environmentalism stuff to you, is a place to go and send them. And I used that to get an A on an essay within which I literally argued that the roads should be privatised to save the environment.
It's quite funny how you can, again, twist a lot of rhetoric. There's a lot of political thinking, especially in the mainstream, that you don't even have to go in and debunk the Marxist theory. There's so much surface level stuff that people believe can just be, like you've talked about with me in private, just asking people, why do you believe that?
Well, see, that, no, that's the deeper question than why do you think that? Because why do you believe that is a presumption that, you know, well, not a presumption, but you are guiding them into the fact that what they are doing is not engaging in political thought. They are having faith in something, because ultimately they have faith in nothing else. They do not have faith in their fellow man, so they must have faith in the structure.
Yes, that they must. They must, you know, kind of, what would the word be? They must defer to the power structure.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, it's almost a further derivation of Protestantism, and that Protestantism kind of, and also Catholicism to a certain extent, but it focused on the material aspects of the church, and that your faith was no longer necessarily in a sense to between you and God, it was between you, God, and the church.
Yes.
And that's almost like the perfect predecessor to faith being between you, the state, and God. And at some point, as something along the lines of, you know, like, you know, in America, as God no longer becomes the thing that justifies the Declaration of Independence or the Bill of Rights or the Articles of Confederation or anything like that, then they all become meaningless bits of paper because they do not have any underwritten higher power to them.
Oh, and as I've been cheekily going around and very much annoying people by doing, I would also encourage you just to read the Bible.
Yeah.
No, seriously, if you want to understand Western history and understand history kind of pre-1950, really, you know, the atheist mindset of the West is a very modern invention.
I mean, to a certain extent, if you're someone who is not interested in being an activist or is not interested in being an intellectual, if you can read the Bible and get a ethic out of it that isn't universalist, you don't need anything else. You're kind of set at that point, really.
Well, it's probably going to be a stream in of itself where we talk about basically, a lot of the post-war consensus when we get to it of being a, whether you believe it's a good thing or bad thing, deliberate period of godlessness.
Well, it's not godlessness. It is. This is the thing again. I gained out of Rothbard's History of Econ. When you look at the, he doesn't explicitly say it, but the communists act in the exact same manner as the radical Anabaptists.
Oh, okay.
They
It's it's
they
and
are they are unchristian, but they
yeah.
still have radical faith in
Well, they do.
something.
It's faith without really a. I guess they have a functional god, but I mean, as in traditional religious god,
That's what I
as in.
mean. They don't have a transcendent power they believe in that is non-material,
Yeah.
and it is not, the direct Christian canon.
They are still faith-based, and it's still religiosity, but it's a very different kind of religiosity.
Yes, because I think you would not be able to get such. You would not get people to act upon values in the way that they do without them believing in it. If it
No.
was just something that they thought. I mean, people think all sorts of things throughout the day, but a lot of the time they do not act on these thoughts. They act on things that they believe. I mean, that's part of the, again, the insights even from Austrian economics and the pure economics framework is that individuals act not because they know, but because they believe their actions will change the situation in the future. Whether that's right or wrong is totally irrespective of the fact that they have this belief.
Well, stepping outside of specifically the Hopper stuff, I guess we have them for a bit there, but there's a great running thread in all of this material that it really does answer the question that we're watching. Was it? It's not Anthony Sutton. That's the other historian guy. The guy who does the documentaries.
Adam
Adam
Curry,
Curtis, yeah.
yes.
Adam Curtis's documentaries where what's the economic? It's not. My brain keeps going back to Hegel, but the economics guy who you asked about altruism.
No, he's not properly an economist, but you're talking about the game theory dude.
Yeah.
Oh God, I should be able
No,
to.
no, 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 no. The other guy. Not the game theory dude. I'm having a
Oh,
brain
is it
fart here.
Buchanan maybe?
It's not Buchanan. No, it's it begins with a H. It's another one of those 20th century philosophers who's very. Influential, and like I said, you're witnessing a brain fart live on air here, but I've just completely forgotten. But the question of altruism and self-interest is ultimately that altruism is
No,
self-interested.
I think you are talking about the John Nash, the game theory dude. I think that's who was
It wasn't
discussing.
John Nash, no, it
No,
was.
I'm almost certain it was because the whole thing
Well, they
under.
ask him as well, but it's
I think the point
it's
was
Hayek.
Hayek as well,
They ask
but
Hayek about self, about altruism,
yes.
and he maybe it's cut together weirdly, maybe it's deceptively edited, but he fumbles the answer. And there's a very just a very straight answer of altruism is self-interested
Yes,
because it
that and
is.
that's the psychic profit idea is that, you believe you will feel happier or you will gain more utility out of the situation if you were to give money to charity because for whatever reason you believe that to be better than not. And to a certain extent, for you to engage in economic analysis in regards to that, you don't need to really delve any deeper.
It's just it's a great elucidation. It just works.
Yes.
It's just like look, if it's within people's interest to cooperate. It's within people.
Yeah.
It's like the whole idea of non-zero sum economic activity.
Yeah, well, so that's more the John Nash idea is that he believed that a lot of economic actors were acting under the pretension that it didn't help other people to make
Yeah.
profits, which even though people aren't for the most part rich in the literature of Austrian economics, they have an implicit understanding that if they go out and do their bit and
Yeah.
other people go out and do their bit, then we can all make this whole big economy thing work. And that without the sort of implicit understanding, much kind of like the Christian ethic in a certain sense, that if we don't go out and do our own bit and we don't have faith that other people will go out and do their own bit, then it doesn't really work.
No, it's ultimately that people who believe in police states, essentially, or who believe in the social contract and the fact that society and coercion, and the police is what stops us all from murdering each other.
Yes.
Have a much dimmer view of the human condition and the human spirit than, say, you know, an Austrian economist does.
Well, yeah, it's the sort of discussion, again, we have had kind of in private whilst planning and researching a lot of this stuff, is that if the average person understood how much of their day was actually anarchy,
yeah,
they would sort of break the shackles of a lot of the stuff that they believe in. I mean, there is no one sort of arm of the state that keeps you in tow every waking minute of every waking day, but that is ultimately what's something that the social contract is essentially stipulating.
Well, it's, again, it comes back to the idea that we're going to come round back to very heavily in the end of it, because we started very heavily on it, which was the panopticon of the series.
Yes.
And what happens is you go through all of this, and people end up in a situation where
they become their own prison guard.
Yeah,
and the doors and the bars on the panopticon are illusionary,
yeah,
and they are part of your own mind and part of your own propagandizing.
Again, we're going to have to get into all kinds of stuff in subsequent screens. We're going to have to talk about public education as its own dedicated subject. We're going to have to get into a lot of stuff as well that's more esoteric. I'm hoping at some point to talk about, you know, the man's environment and a lot of the man in the stars and a lot of the history stuff as well.
Yes.
The age of history and the lie of history.
We're going to get some people Santos Bonacci pilled.
So, well, we can talk about the fact that most of humanity's earliest stories were about, you know, the movement of the stars and things like that, which is true. And you get to some really, really base principle stuff about how the human mind not only works but evolved.
Mm.
It's, you know, that's ultimately the elucidation that you want to get down to. You want to get people into a mindset and kind of de-propagandized and deprogrammed into a world where they can really see themselves as, you know, more powerful beings and,
yes,
more spiritual beings in a way as well, and that they can go beyond what is the ultra-materialism of much of what we see in what the modern world presents as a solution.
It's going to eventually bring in who is slowly becoming one of my favourite political thinkers, and it's going to maybe sound a bit odd to describe him as a political thinker, but Ted Kaczynski. He is ultimately one of the most tactful and one of the most insightful political thinkers that exists on the right. I mean, if you were to go off and read Technological Slavery in full, and you understood the fact that he is talking from a position about Evola, he's talking about a position from almost Hoppe in a certain sense, and Lenin, and all these different characters, there is so much to grasp out of it. I mean, I don't know, maybe if it's something you would want to pull up at all, it's something we'll be referencing next week, but there was a piece that I recently wrote about how Francis and Ted Kaczynski are, for the most part, saying the exact same thing.
Yes.
And that the way in which Ted Kaczynski sees technology and the way in which Sam Francis see managerialism, they are describing the same process. Yes.
Is it the manufacturing consent one?
Yes, it is.
There we go. I've got it up there.
Yeah, and yeah, so I kind of stole the idea of the title of Noam Chomsky and his mate's work, Edward Herman, who's some guy that just never receives any credit for it, despite the fact that most of the work was his. And obviously, because Noam Chomsky's a dirty communist, he stole all the credit for it.
It's always the case. It's always the commies.
I mean, maybe Edward Herman was some sort of reasonably attractive androgynous figure that was doing all this complex political thinking for Noam Chomsky or something like that. I don't know.
At least we try and credit you at every opportunity, really.
No, I'm half taken.
I guess, so yeah, we are going to transcend, boys. Like, we are going to. Like, you thought we were getting a bit more out of the realms of, did you guys know that feminism was bad with this series? You should see what's coming.
Yes.
Because there is going to be some, as you would say, rather fried shit going on. And I hope you will come with us with it. But, it's quite funny. It's quite funny that a lot of people, they seem very open to this stuff, and it seems very alien at first, but, you know, if you get it, you get it. And I would hope the people in here have been open-minded enough to come with us with the democratization stuff.
I think especially with some of the stuff I'm describing in this piece we have in front of us, it's stuff I have not really seen mentioned elsewhere. Maybe that's just because I'm ignorant of where someone else is doing the same sort of writing, but I think when you finally throw something that is entirely new in people's faces, it sort of, for a brief moment, essentially rips them out of the framework that they've always existed in.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, as I said, a piece we'll be using to reference sort of next week if when the sort of Keynesian stuff we're talking about.
But we're only referencing quite a narrow part of it.
Yeah, no, that's true, and it's not necessarily the main function of it, but
no.
The reason why TED is so powerful is that if you look through TED and you see the notions of simplification and detachment from the real processes that you should be involved in.
Yeah.
I mean, even though we all like the fact that we have pizzas in the freezer, the fact that we have pizzas in the freezer all the time means that we at no point have to consider the fact that when the food runs out, we starve to death.
Yes.
In the same way that when you have the police state, you don't ever have to consider the fact that you must defend your property. You know, we become lackadaisical and we live in a sort of simplified world that only really exists in our head. You know, ultimately at the end of the day, much like I was discussing, we live in anarchy from day to day. But the notion of the police state or the total state in a panopticon ultimately then puts forward this notion in our own heads that for some reason we are always protected and we are always safe.
Is it technological slavery the one that you've got?
Yeah, technological slavery is the one I've read most recently. There is other stuff that I would like to get into, but it's the one I would recommend as the most summarised sort of piece of Ted Kaczynski's work, because within that you have a revised form of industrial society in its future, which is the original manifesto.
Yeah. And also, the Amazon page up here.
But... And also within it is a lot of concurrent writing that he has done in regards to discussing eco-activism as what he refers to as surrogate activism and surrogate activities. And furthermore, the sort of nature by which reformist behaviour is you just becoming part of something that is a movement that ultimately engages in no change in the world. It's inconsequential. You know, technology, both in a physical and a mental sense, removes you from the processes that would actually allow you to engage in consequential changes in the real world.
Yes, yes, they do. There's been a couple of questions in the chat about, you know, what our actual viewpoints are, and, you know, a lot of people seem very confused by the fact that we don't have a, well, at least I don't have a very hard stance ideologically. Which,
well, I think
is
that's
deliberate.
I think that's because also to a certain extent with me introducing you to a lot of this stuff, it's made you sort of not necessarily reconsider, but possibly think more deeply about if you were to place yourself somewhere, where would that place be?
Well, there's someone who was asking, sorry, I missed it, I can't seem to find it here, asking whether we were like high trust societyists or, you know, full on ANCAPs. I know you are.
Well, I think the point would more be that I am someone who describes myself as philosophically an ANCAP, and that is an ideal that if it was achievable, I would like to move towards. But it is something that I see as, you know, it is the measuring stick by which I put all other philosophies or ideologies up against. However, I am cognizant of the fact that as soon as you get into the realms of politics, the ideals and the philosophy of that not necessarily become useless, but that they do not inform how to win in politics. That's where the Lenin, and that's where, you know, maybe even getting into the regards of why Pol Pot didn't like university lecturers is something that you should really have a consideration about.
Well, what I would say is as well that a lot of this stuff we're presenting, I would really like people to come to their own conclusions on.
Oh, no, not entirely.
That's the biggest thing, is that most of this thinking is ultimately non-hegemonic. As
yes.
long as you understand a lot of the base principles on it, what you believe personally and what you get out of it personally, within the framework of individualism and, you know, minimizing the impacts and control of the state, it doesn't act, you know, this is one of the only worldviews that does not require hegemony.
Well, it's anti-positivist.
Yes, it is.
It stands on its own merits and it doesn't require a circular relationship with, you know, empirical basis or a utilitarian basis that ultimately requires some physiocratic understanding of man as, you know, the Hobbesian nature or the Marxian nature and all this kind of guff, essentially.
Yeah. It's not a question of what we want you to believe. It's a question of we want to show you how to arrive at a conclusion that isn't based around propaganda, that isn't based around the coercion of your fellow man.
I think there is also, though, that we have also used some sources, and maybe this is another thing we can kind of move into, like Anthony C. Sutton's work.
Yes,
within
wonderful.
Which you begin to understand the power sort of figures and the power structure that you're ultimately up against, and it is, to a certain extent, is phrased by a number of interesting characters as the international financiers.
There's lots of angles of it, and lots of angles of it that make people very angry because they start to scream anti-Semitism.
Yes,
but
that's the sort of the joke, half kind of joking point I was making to you earlier on in the chat, is that it doesn't really matter who's at the helm of the thing.
No.
The fact that there is something to be at the helm of is the issue.
Yeah, you can really bypass a lot of that stuff of you know, naming them, quote unquote.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter who them is. It matters that there is a them.
Yes, precisely. In the same way that you don't have to be a racist to make points about segregation or discrimination.
Yeah,
you know, it is, once you have a deep understanding of Hoppe, you begin to understand that discriminating on your own property in an absolutist sense is actually how you set standards in society without having to be one of these trads that thinks if you ban casual sex then everything's going to be alright. Because I'll be honest, I found that absolutely hilarious that the government, the UK government, re-legalised casual sex the other week and all the trads went rolling in their graves. I mean, isn't this something that they should have been in support of?
Yeah, the state has been meddling in people's bedrooms in exactly the way that you wanted. Why weren't you celebrating? Why weren't you on the streets telling them to keep this in place?
Yep.
It's because that their commitments, and I think to a great degree their worldview, doesn't hang together.
No.
Because they just want what we have right now, but with a few racist posters on it.
Well, it's also the fact that to a certain extent, like, you know, their very institutions and the quote-unquote leftist right-wingers that they hate, which I also hate too, but they did what they wanted.
Yes. They did do what they wanted.
And it comes down to the fact that ultimately those in positions of power do not have any sort of contingent ideology. They have no philosophy with which you can refer to.
Nope.
I mean, there are philosophical lenses through which you might be able to understand some of their intentions or their motivations, but ultimately, again, a work like Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution or Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, which is the one I would more refer to because I think it's slightly more in-depth. It is the one, maybe one of the biggest red pills ever, really, because what you begin to understand...
He names the names and he shows the connections.
Yeah, you know, he essentially suggests, without explicitly saying that, you know, Hitler is like the ultimate patsy.
Yeah.
And he just at some point decided to get let loose by his handlers. And so much of the events that happened in Germany at the time were almost something that I would argue is a bit of a distraction from the real nature of what happened, which was America created a war state to go to war with to then essentially destroy any form of proper traditionalism or monarchism.
Well, it's also kind of the story with Stalin as well and the Bolsheviks in general.
Well, I think it's more actually that story really begins with Lenin.
Yeah.
I mean, I think even though I don't really have much to reference on in regards to this, it was something, again, I suggested on a stream the other day. Lenin, to me, seems like a character that is so Machiavellian. I think he was consciously aware at the time that he was taking American money to be their patsy.
Mm.
And at one point, he basically decided, no, I'm not being your patsy before. And that's when him and Trotsky get the fucking nick.
Yeah.
And Stalin gets rolled in.
Yeah,
and it seems to me like Stalin was
their
guy.
Their ears start burning, yeah.
Yeah. The ears start oof.
No, my ears are burning. It's kind of a case with Stalin too, in the West thought he was their guy, and he wasn't.
Oh yes, because Lenin would not have fought World War II, is sort of what I'm insinuating here.
Yes, that
he
is very
true. He would not have been their guy to that level, because I don't think he was someone that was so... It was Machiavellian, but not in the sense that he was willing to sacrifice his own people in the way that Hitler wasn't.
Mm.
Hitler was a nationalist insofar as the fact that he sacrificed most of his nation to go to a pointless war.
Well, like I said, Anthony C. Sutton really is described as a Well, they keep calling him a rogue historian and distant intellectual, but he's really just someone who can show you that history is a lie and has
he's,
the proof.
He's a man with a book full of receipts.
Yes, he got them receipts.
It's just so good.
It's very. I would. Yeah. If you're not interested in a lot of the economic stuff, just read yeah. Sutton's work.
Yeah. If you just want the basic facts on why the events of World War One and World War Two happened and who was behind making sure these things happened, Sutton's work is the place to go.
There's a comment here that it's hard to get anywhere if you don't understand the root motivations, which is kind of, again, I don't want to ruin next week's stream at all, but the whole thread we'll be getting to, which actually starts picking up here again, is unaccountable power.
Yes, and those in power do the philosophizing bit backwards. The philosophizing is sort of is antecedent, would that be the correct phrase, in regards to the functional power gains that they're really after.
Yes. It's a big one, and it's again, it's interesting because within the Austrian framework, you can talk about, like we talked about, you know, mutually beneficial exchange.
Mm.
And that most people and most human beings do not want that level of unaccountable power and do not want to go through the things that you go through to get that level of unaccountable power. And it brings us on to a very prescient topic of you know, what we have today, which is essentially an elite full of what we can prove are nonces, they're child molesters.
Yeah.
And unaccountable power is extremely attractive to people who either want to implement a worldview, who either want to impose their beliefs on somebody for a certain purpose, or people who want to undertake extreme deviant behaviour.
And get away with it.
Yeah, or most likely both.
Yes, because the two seem to go hand in hand.
Well, one helps perpetuate the other. In that if you want,
in what order?
It's what came first, the nonce, the
tyrant.
The tyrant. It's a real point that most normal people don't want to engage in these processes. Most even, quote-unquote, elites or, you know, higher intelligence individuals do not want to take part in these processes.
Mm.
They find much more satisfaction and much more, you know, psychic profit, to use that term, in cooperating properly with others rather than attempting to coerce them completely into their will.
Yes, well, that is this sort of notion I've tried to put across to some people is that only tyrants wield power. Any true leader, power is actually granted to them without the need for, you know, a bit of paper or a gun to your head to, you know, gather the will of those around you.
It's a very, very good point. I don't know. I'm trying to think of anything else we need to mention with Sutton at all. He has a good book on FDR as well. That's his third one.
Well, again, that gets into the realms of, I think, I don't know in Bolsheviks, but I know towards the end of Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, he essentially puts forward his own sort of worldview in a very small way. I don't know if you've read that section or not yet.
No.
But he essentially posits, you know, an anti-total state sort of position, because he understands not through a large amount of libertarian theory, but through this, you know, these receipts and these functional relationships that he studied, that
he's looked at history and figured it out.
Yes.
And what you see with you know, Mises and Rothbard, they look at economics and figure it out.
Yes. It's ultimately that if you look at power dynamics for long enough, the true nature of human interaction speaks through you back, you know, speaks back through sort of into it. Maybe that's, I've not worded that the best way, but I think the general sort of idea is kind of there that, you know, you only have to look at the logic of how humans interact for so long before you begin to understand. If you tell someone that they have ultimate power but no responsibility in regards to making sure they use that power in any sensible form, they will abuse it. It's the Lord Acton quote, you know, power corrupts and true, you know, ultimate power, or sorry, absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Well, it's a bit of a, well, not a spoiler for the series really, but that's why we do the whole kind of like raw power analysis at the end of each episode.
Yes.
That's why that is the summing up.
Mm.
You look at who functionally gains power and authority, and spoiler alert, every single time the state expands, the state expands, the state expands. And, you know, you can argue, you know, till the cows come home about the validity of the power of the state, and people who believe in the social contract, they have to admit that they believe in coercion, but, you know, at least they'd be willing to admit that sometimes. But if you have an ever-expanding state, inevitably, where does that lead?
Mm.
It leads to, you know, furthering totalitarianism. It seems that it's like what I talked about last time with people being leftists to a certain degree, and that their line is just different, and that the thing that makes them short circuit is different. They have a different pet issue. But it seems when it comes to the state and totalitarianism, people just quibble about where the line is rather than seeing the process. They say, well, you know, this isn't totalitarianism, but this is. But eventually, if you go through this process enough and you get enough of these almost like Hegelian iterations towards quote-unquote perfect civilization, you end up with a totalitarian state because the state gets bigger, it never gets smaller through any of this.
So on a long enough timeline, as long as you believe in the absolute state, you are a Hegelian?
Yes. You know,
I mean, there's maybe a whole thing worth discussing in and of itself at some point, which would be like Hegelian conservatism.
It really is a point that you can't, if you believe in the march of history and you believe in the ever iteration upwards, if you functionally believe that's the way history takes shape and has taken shape for the past 100 years, you must be someone who believes in slavery of the human mind.
Well, yeah, it's... Again, it gets back to the sort of nature that so many people need to be sort of uneducated. I mean, not to name an individual who may or may not be unnamed, but part of the reason you sort of kind of fell out with Dev to a certain extent, and then Dev further kind of decided to go on a whole fucking drama-based tirade, was that he ultimately was unwilling to uneducate himself in regards to a lot of the things that underpin his worldview. And whenever those things were brought up or attempted to be addressed, he defaulted back to a position that essentially, you know, he wouldn't even bother to fully elucidate the position of why the social contract was legitimate.
The thing is, social contract theory, people don't like talking about it because it's so retarded.
Yeah, a magic piece of paper says you can't, like, shoot me. This is a no-dying zone.
Magic paper is the same thing as magic soil.
Yes.
It's very much the same logic. If you don't...
Popperianisms be like...
Yeah, it is. It's magic paper, magic soil, and magic paper you put in a box.
Yep. The divination box whereby nothing changes every 4 or 5 years.
It's a whole host of magical thinking in which you believe that through the kind of legal fictions of the state... that inanimate objects and acts of essentially ritual are imbued with these magical transcendent powers to change the world.
It gets into some of the ideas that, you know, the sharp end of Hopper, which is essentially describing democracy and the modern state as a mind virus.
The
government does not exist. There is merely a building with some people in it, and your unadulterated faith in it is the only thing that keeps it functioning.
Yeah, it is a fiction.
Mm.
Much like a lot of the stuff we'll talk about here, like fiat currency.
Yes.
Much like, you know...
Economics is the same sort of thing, but the faith in economics is, again, it's the faith in the fellow man. It's not the faith in some material institution that is going to impose good upon the world.
Well, it's the big thing as well. The state inserts itself as a guarantor against your lack of faith in your fellow human beings.
Yes.
That's what it's predicated on. It's predicated on the fact that you want an entity with the ultimate big stick so they can beat up your neighbour. That's the impulse there.
Uh-huh.
The impulse is that, you know, essentially you're a toady who hides behind a bigger person to beat up people you don't like.
Yep.
That's functionally how it happens.
It's the ultimate sort of weak bully.
Well, again, I'm probably going to repeat myself a few times as we go through this series, as we get towards the end point of really us just making the judgment that democracy not only doesn't work, but is in of itself a ludicrous concept in a mass sense.
As we referenced the piece I wrote before, it is a mental technology that keeps you subservient to the power structure by putting you under the illusion that you can somehow influence it.
Well, a lot of people would spaz out if I said this to them, but, you know, you can laugh at people and say, look, you believe that putting a piece of paper in a box changes the world.
Yeah.
That is the physical process you go through.
And there is an insidious process there where these people not only believe that, but they also believe that when the system functionally goes wrong and other people are hurt, that is somehow their fault.
Yeah, you put a mark on a box and you literally believe that changes the world.
Yes, and you assume the responsibility for when that change goes wrong.
And you believe that you are responsible for that change.
Hmm.
It's
a mind virus.
It is. It's the false response. It's the superstition you imbue in rats by feeding them at random times.
Yeah, or is it maybe a an inverse Munchausen by proxy?
I guess it's almost like the hot hand fallacy as well.
Yes, it's so much of, you know, playing on, even though it's not something I'm a big fan of, playing on sort of heuristic simplicities within our own minds.
Mm.
You know, there is a natural sort of avenue within which people will work towards things that they think are quote unquote easier. I mean, I think if we were to...
What's the other one you wrote?
The other thing I did was on...
Oh, the cryptocurrency one. Yeah,
which is a whole thing about Surik activism. However, I was going to say, if we scroll actually through this a little bit towards near the bottom, there's probably going to be some things we could maybe just directly sort of read off to a certain extent about, like, if we were to go maybe up a little bit, just at the top of that paragraph, I think.
This massive paragraph here.
Sorry, I can't write in short form. It's not my problem. But, you know, as I sort of...
I am a bit zoomed in here too, for the benefit of the children at home.
As I'm sort of discussing here, you know, one of the few things Chomsky identifies, or Chomsky and his mate identifies, is that there is not just the need for the material of propaganda as in the literature, there is also the need for a superstructure around it to make it useful. And there needs to be the symbiosis of both the mental and the physical technology. And once these are propagated out, you get, as I've, you know, derived here from Ted Kaczynski, this idea of learned helplessness, whereby the effort you need to apply in the world around you is minimized so that you don't think you need to really apply yourself to accomplish things.
What I like as well is that you've come up with the whole thing that I was always puzzled by, which is Chomsky and, you know, his mate he stole it all from, are lazy in that they talk about manufacturing consent, and that's what became famous, but they never talk about what it really means and the mechanisms by which it's manufactured.
Yes, because I think further down somewhere in this paragraph is a point I make, which is that, you know, the true function of propaganda in a certain sense is not to convince you of, you know, one position ideologically or the other. It is to convince you that the world you live within is all right, and that you don't need to change it. You know, it's to convince you in the acceptance of the hegemony, and that ultimately this stuff needs to come from the hegemony to be valuable. You know, that's to a certain extent why, even again within TED, he discusses the, not necessarily the futile nature of it, but to some extent it could be suggested that, you know, counter-propaganda is great and all, but ultimately it never hits the same way because it does not come from the place that propaganda typically comes from.
No. Just before, I don't know...
There is the self, the word democratization.
Yeah. Like I said, a lot of this really has just stemmed from discussions between me and Trig, me and you, me, you and Trig. It's a lot of this has just been organic stuff we've talked about ourselves, and we've really just decided to kind of, me and Trig have really been educate yourself. But it is something I've been meaning to dive into for a long time, just haven't had the time or the impetus to, is a lot more of the Austrian theory stuff, because I've come across the edges of it for so long.
Yes.
Kind of skirted around it.
Mm.
And, you know, been reading Mises articles, but not reading the meatier material of the, you know, the books themselves they keep up there. But like I said, we're kind of bringing you with us on this journey of discovery, really.
Well, I think it's more I'm bringing
you're our
you,
guide.
I think I'm more bringing you to well, along yeah, a certain... Because, when must I... I think I really get heavy into reading sort of last year when I began to understand that I was never really fully going to grasp what was going on around me unless I could get into essentially the deep sort of elitist understanding of certain ideas.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a backwards process, you know, as I tried to suggest that to a certain extent, understanding a lot of theory on face value isn't actually that useful. It is only when you have a large theoretical understanding mixed in with a power analysis that it becomes useful, because then you understand functionally what the arguments actually give to these people.
Yes, you do. You start to, again, you start to understand the power it gives them too.
And again, that's why Francis's work is so sort of prevalent and important in regards to this stuff, and will become ever more sort of prevalent within it, because to a certain extent, as we move along in the way that we have, there is a necessity for the mask to slip, because they're running out of options other than just explicitly giving you the brief description of here is what's actually happening in regards to power analysis. You know, they're almost in a certain sense telling you that we rule and do not question this.
There's a couple of ones I wanted to mention. I think we skimmed over them a little bit. You've seen them referenced, but Rothbard's Great Depression and Rothbard's Progressive Era are both available on the Mises Institute, and they're both very good materials for this period.
Yes, it's a lot of good contextual stuff, I think.
Yes, it's very good contextual stuff. And that's why I've been going through the history stuff and not just the theory stuff. I know the Q&A we did in this stream is a bit more theory-heavy, which is by design. And the streams will get a bit more theory heavy once we get past the time period, because we're going to have like three conclusively streams, because like I said, we've had to just talk about the lies of historical events to essentially have a good reference point for deep. I know a lot of you guys know quite a few of these things already with the historical stuff, and you know, may have read around it yourselves, but we have to do the legwork and essentially show people step by step functionally in history how all this took place. And Progressive Era and America's Great Depression are really just America's Great Depression, especially a lot of last week's stream was us just reading from it, because it's so good. he is so watertight with that document there. With that book there, that it you know, there really wasn't many other sources that we had to bring in for a lot of the topics we wanted to discuss, because it's very complete, and like I said, it's just a good read as well. They are genuinely very readable books.
Yes, I mean, I don't know, I'm someone that can't really read fiction, to be honest, so it's probably not surprising that I find this stuff as interesting as I do. Maybe that's a wider commentary on the state of one's own mind, but.
So as we get more towards kind of a conclusory point here, I don't know how much more stuff you want to bring up.
I'm not really sure. I was just wondering, actually, if anyone, I don't know, was sort of specifically kind of maybe take questions for a little bit, if there's anything anyone's cleared up.
If you guys have, I know the chat's a teeny bit slow at the moment. If you guys want to donate as well, I will shill again. There's a donation link pinned in the chat and in the description there. my Discord's there as well, and so is your Twitter. I've linked your Twitter down below. I've already put it in the description. I've not been lax. I will shill minds.com again. It slowed down a little bit, as a lot of alt social media tends to, but it is still one of the best places to go. It is, you know, basically the place you can reach me. Shilling stuff out there. But
I don't know, Yiz has picked up on some form of Hegelianism there, that we need governance until there is a breakthrough of evolution. I don't know about that one.
It depends what you... Again, you need to define... We can have a whole discussion about, you know, what can be defined as governance.
Oh, but, I mean, there will always be power dynamics, but there is no need always for the absolute state. That's one thing I would suggest entirely, in that ultimately you suggesting that there must be the state is you giving the Marxists and the Hobbesians and the Hegelians all the power to do whatever they want, because there is no mediation of the total state.
Governance might be replaced by something better, which is why I like ANCAP stuff. Yeah, the thing is, a lot of the stuff that people hang on to as functions of the state is arbitrary, in that, you know, if we lived in a world where all cars were manufactured by the state and given to individuals like a Soviet nation, we'd go, how will cars, you know, cars are unfeasible to manufacture in the private sector. How will these things exist without the state?
Oh, no, it turns out I was reading that wrong to a certain extent, fair enough.
I think you didn't read the whole comment. I think they're getting it. Oh, you're getting dunked on. Getting dunked on by the chat.
Dunked on by chat. This is not good.
Oh, dear, that's quite funny. I don't know. It's a case of... Like I said, everyone will have a different take on this. And everyone will have a different line where they want things to be. But, like I said, as long as you recognise that there is no reforming or voting our way out of the current situation, that's when we can really start having a discussion.
And we can try and keep it intellectual so that ultimately it is not as fed posty as it needs to be. Because this is so much of what this stuff needs to do. I mean, we basically need to play the same game they have played, which is use really high-level intellectual chat to ultimately suggest that we need to point guns at all these people and tell them to stop, or we will actually shoot them.
That's the, you know, in Minecraft, of course.
Yes, of course, sorry, in Roblox.
You know, hypothetically, you know, it's kind of, well, it's a framework as well of, a lot of people can't conceive of political action outside of the very, very narrow confines of what we refer to as the political process, which is a whole quagmire in itself. But ultimately, if you guys are wondering, you know, what our end point of all of this is, and what our belief system is, and why we're saying all of this, and, you know, I've been accused by a couple of people of just deconstructivism and trying to, you know, criticize without offering alternatives, which I don't think is really the point here. What we're doing is we're trying to build up a body of evidence that we can then use to come to a judgment. But, you know, you need to do the legwork before you can make the conclusions. And that's what a lot of people, I don't think, have done.
Yes.
Especially when they're trying to, you know, debate in this area philosophically. They're trying to have a very advanced debate without knowing really the underpinnings of it.
Yeah, because you cannot really engage in true philosophical analysis if all philosophical analysis is underwritten by your own ideological position. I mean, I am not a big fan of the concept of neutrality in regards to politics or institutions, but if you want to be true and fair in regards to philosophical sort of discussions and then philosophically comment on political discussions, you must sort of stand at a point whereby you aren't actually coming in with any assumptions.
Well, there's ultimately the case of you have to have the faith of in the contents of your own mind.
Yes.
And if you don't have that internal fortitude, and you can't engage honestly and know where you lack knowledge and where you need to, you know, exercise as an expert, where you can say, look, I can speak on this because I know this, 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 and this, and to the best of my ability, you know, I can make a judgment here, you're never going to be of any use to anyone. I think a lot of people's political argumentation just smacks of insecurity more
yes,
than
yes, I think there's also a lot of sort of binary thought in regards to the fact that any notion of any possible relativism, which almost all Austrian economics is underwritten within,
yeah,
is somehow postmodernist, well, and that's bad, and that what they are missing in that is that the postmodernists, to a certain extent, are right in regards to a lot of things being relative.
Yeah, but they misapply it.
Well, yes, they misapply it because they put that before the power structure instead of realizing that the relativism comes because there is a power structure that must be justified.
Well, they also try and apply relativism to areas where relativism just doesn't apply.
Yeah, no, that is also true. There is no relativism in ethics.
No.
Ethics is maybe one of the few areas where there is just things that are objectively true and objectively untrue.
Well, there's also the issue that you can talk about, you know, mathematics is a human product, but within the hard sciences, you can't say, well, you know, this result is relative.
Yeah, there is no such thing as relativistic logic.
No. And there's no such thing as, you know, functionally, you know, we have to accept the limits of the fact that we live inside our own minds. And that's not a limiting thing. It's actually quite a freeing thing.
Yes.
And once you accept that, you know, we do have shared perceptions and we do have shared, you know, ways of filtering the world, and that, you know, you are not trapped inside your own mind. You are, you know, your mind is the way in which you absorb reality to a actually quite precise degree.
Well, as we've sort of discussed more of this stuff, you know, it becomes almost to a certain extent sort of obvious that so much of this actually kind of points to God in a certain way.
Well, people's belief in God and people's belief in higher powers and people's, you know, spirituality, there's, again, it's something we'll talk about way at the end of all of this, but really a lot of the modern managerialism, a lot of the modern total state stuff lacks any sort of spirituality or even metaphysics. It doesn't have anything to say to the human soul.
No.
That's why people describe it as, you know, soulless and empty. They're reaching for language. I don't think we should be afraid of more spiritual language, because there is a worldview here that is so much greater and so much more transcendent than just the material.
Is the, you know, the sort of nature that no amount of ideology can replace the need for faith.
Yes.
That's ultimately why, even though some people have political thoughts, they still have political beliefs on top of that. And the beliefs are the things they act upon.
Yes, it ultimately you need a belief structure, and some of that will be predicated on a degree of faith. And, you know, that's admitting that isn't a weakness. Admitting that's, I think, a strength, because a lot of people who have these purely, you know, the fedora tipping frameworks, really, who have a view of reality that they believe is empirical and neutral, those are much more dangerous.
Yes, well, that's the sort of... Those are the people that would be entirely unwilling to admit the neutrality only exists in the abstract. Neutrality in the real world is not real.
Again, insofar as, you know, ideas that you can say are subjective, especially like constructs like politics.
Yes, it's more the empiricism is both underwritten within its own value set, and furthermore is always interpreted by someone who has a subjective value set.
Yeah, it is. But like I said, it's the big kind of no-no people have with postmodernism, and a lot of that is its encroachment into, you know, the hard sciences, where it really belongs in places like economics.
Yes.
Where you really just have to admit that people's desires are not measurable and are fully subjective moment to moment.
Yes, it's the point that a number of the sort of Austrian economist writers throughout a long time have made, which is that the unfalsifiability of social sciences is actually a good thing. It is not a failure of it.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, there should be no unfalsifiable versions of the quote unquote scientific method, because it doesn't fit.
Human action is a good one for that.
Yes.
That's a great one to get into if you want to talk about, you know, the relativistic nature of human desire, which, you know, it seems, if you talk about it like that, it seems obvious that, you know, the inside of people's minds is relative. Again, it's something we'll get into more in the next stream, because that's very important when it comes to economic calculations, but it's underpinned entirely when it comes to democracy as well, because you are reducing to essentially a binary choice the hopes, dreams, wants, desires, and future plans of millions of people.
Yep.
And you believe that doing that will create utopia, or at least you're selling that idea to those people.
Well, it's a patchwork to hide the fact that they really can't actually plan shit.
Hmm. Yeah, like, it's, again, the determinism comes into it, in that if you believe in the planning of an economy, you're indulging in, you know, deterministic economics, in that you believe that there is a logical shape to the way that the economy will form.
Yes.
And that just functionally isn't true.
No.
It's the same with, you know, human desire and you know, human ethic as well, in the way that people's thought process and belief systems evolve. You can't plan for that. And if you believe there should be a shape to history, if you are someone who not only believes that the march of history exists, but that it should be guided by you, that makes you the ultimate kind of tyrant. Those are the people that we see consistently throughout this. That's why we ragged so much on Woodrow Wilson, because he is the perfect example of someone who believes that he can guide the march of history. And once you start believing in it, once you start believing you can guide it, you become someone who's incredibly dangerous. And that's what almost all the figures we see who claw themselves to the top of the managerial structure, they all believe that they are, you know, the guardians of history.
They see themselves to a certain extent as their own gods.
Yes, they do. And that's what has been mentioned repeatedly throughout this series, that they functionally, you know, as far as they can, come closer and closer to what on Earth is the equivalent of a god, because as the state becomes more powerful,
it must become all-seeing and it must become all-knowing to functionally work, which is, of course, impossible. So they must create further and further innovations to hide this illusion.
And that's where you get to really the subsummation of God into the state by a lot of Marxist ideas. And really they are anti-religious, in that they see that as a competing impulse for people.
Mm.
And that they should really subsume themselves not to God, but to the state as God. And that's, you know, becomes very, very obvious when you look at things in this framework. And again, there's a lot of stuff that comes out of this, and a lot of people who've been commenting here and commenting on that in the previous episodes very obviously understand that quite inherently. They have, you know, they've made the connections there, and it's not something I think a lot of people tend to do.
No.
I mentioned to you about the fact that, you know, a lot of people can't seem to understand that the calculation problem also extends to human happiness to an even greater degree in many ways.
Yes.
You can't, you know, calculate what is the greatest amount of happiness to the greatest amount of people? That is, you know, the sin of utilitarianism.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we talked about that at the beginning of this series. And all of this is underpinned by people trying to do that. They are trying to do, you know...
You're playing God.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And what you get to eventually is you get to the state where they say, well, we just need, you know, if only we had all the information, we could calculate this.
Yes, so they must look inside your home, steal all your data, well, so that you have no privacy. Well,
ultimately, they must attempt to look inside your mind.
Mm.
And, you know...
Let's not get into the Elon Musk brain chips.
Well, it is. That they believe that if they can analyse the inside of everyone's head, that they can create this perfect system everybody.
I think it's sort of past that point to a certain extent, whereby they have come to sort of full circle in so far as the fact that they cannot know everything inside your head, so they would rather instead implant ideas inside your head so that they at least have the best idea of what you would commit your faith to.
Or at least they can try and, you know, guide what you commit your faith to, yeah. Another donation here from Glowy, $5, thank you for that. So elite power dynamics is merely based on perception, power manipulation, and brute force. As long as you control perception, you can literally justify power manipulation and brute force.
Yes.
Yes, basically. It's, you know, I am strong, I set the news, and I create reality because I write history. I set the news. It becomes that. It's ultimately boils down to a might makes right type argument.
Well, the best way to predict the future is to make it.
Yes. Oh, where's that from? There's quite a few places that have said that.
Mm.
It's a good one. Trying to think in terms of literature, is there anything else I need to elucidate? I'm running out of scrump gas, I think, now.
No, I don't. I mean, there are a couple of other things that we brought in, like Hoppe's a theory of socialism and capitalism, which is quite a nice, concise work.
Yes.
But I think it's, to a certain extent, if you really want to grasp what we have tried to put forward via all these different sort of parts of the series, if you were to go off and essentially read Francis, Mises, Hoppe, and Rothbard, and really any sort of order, providing that you have a basic understanding of the Marxist framework, the basic liberal framework, and you've at least dipped your toes into Austrian economics enough to want to read into it more, then it's really all sort of there.
Oh, there it is. Sorry, I'll try and get this on screen just so you guys can have a little bit of a visual idea of what it looks like. But you did mention theory of socialism.
Yes, it's a reasonably concise work for Hoppe, really.
Yes, it's a good one. Again, it's available for free on the Mises Institute, like most of this stuff is.
Well, it's also a free audiobook, I believe.
Yes, it's like I said, it's very easy to do a lot of this reading. That's why a lot of these sources are being used over and above certain other sources, because they're just so accessible, and that accessibility is really something that helps you guys. You know, we only have a finite amount of time here, and I don't want to be one of those people who's just like, you know, read. You know, you need to do the reading. But
it's kind of true.
We can facilitate that, and we can bring you as far as we can in the time that we have. And, you know, I think it's unfair when a lot of Marxists just hand wave away the flaws in their argument by saying that you haven't read the right theory. Because, you know, ultimately, it is their job to explain their worldview to you in a way that makes sense. You know, that's what they should be doing. And if their worldview doesn't make sense, you know, in a proper way, they should be guiding you towards wanting to do more research rather than just throwing that in your face, which I think is what we're trying to do here. It's a case of, I don't know, what I want to try and do is make these ideas, they are quite accessible already, but make them as accessible as possible to people who really want to learn.
Yes.
Sorry, go on.
And that contextualizing it via sort of a historical study is sort of a way to give you a real-world example that you could go and look at through a number of sources to further sort of contextualize the theory and the dynamics that we are pointing to.
Yeah, it is. It's, again, we're trying to bring you with us as far as we can, but we, like I said, we have a finite amount of time and a finite amount of resources here. But, you know, if you listen to the series, you listen to some of the wider stuff that we've done, and you do a lot of the reading, It'd be very difficult if you are truly engaging with the subject matter not to come to some kind of conclusion, that essentially there needs to be at least a mass demolishing of what we regard as the state if we want to be free as human beings, and if we want to enhance our own conditions and, exercise our own will and, enhance our own happiness, within our own frameworks. We need to be able to exercise some degree of individual control over our own lives. That is kind of fundamental. And if you believe in freedom, I think that you, unless you have some kind of investment in it, unless you really just think that you need to coerce people because they are corrupt and evil and otherwise will destroy each other and themselves, I can't see people not adopting at least some. I don't see people not getting something out of this. To at least enhance or maybe refine their worldview. You'd have to be someone who has an extreme rejection of either the human spirit or, a warped understanding of human interaction,
Well,
not to absorb at least a bit of this stuff.
because as well, what we're sort of working on here is we're technically kind of building a bit of a historical narrative,
Yes.
which is something that I think a certain subset of the right has been working on, but it hasn't really been widespread enough. And
No.
I'm aware this isn't the largest circle either, really, to spread these ideas through, but ultimately, if no one is willing to talk about this stuff and no one's willing to sort of elucidate the thoughts around it, no one's ever going to really properly understand it, and they're never going to apply the. Because, to a certain extent, what we are doing is we are consolidating our thoughts, we are consolidating terminology, we are making sure that we have a more refined understanding of this is what this term means, this is what we describe when we use this theory. And that even if you were someone that fully understood all of this stuff, I myself have come to even stronger and more full-on conclusions about the things I previously thought and previously believed in by really working all of these points through history and
Yes.
seeing them come to fruition through it.
Well, it's also a case of through you essentially educating me, and through me attempting to educate an audience, we all enhance our own understandings and we test our ideas and we refine our ideas. And by trying to relay them to other people, we have to make them hang together in a logical way.
Yes.
It really just elucidates the gaps in your worldview and some of the leaps in your thinking. And, what I really want to do is give people some surety in their own minds as well. That's ultimately what this is. It's not really about, attacking the leftists or owning the libs. It's about you being able to, think of yourself not as a small part in a large world, but as someone who has some actual power to change things.
Yes,
Because.
you just need to think about things in the right way and truly understand where your, essentially to a certain extent, anger and passion should be directed at, which is not, as in part things like leftist ideology, but it's ultimately the structures that keep leftist ideology propagating within the West that we must attack. It is not just the university lecturers, it is the university as a thing.
Yeah, it's not just the bad actors in the police force, or it's not just
There
police
is no
reform.
such thing as good cops when it is state police. It's the Lew Rockwell sort of point on the issue.
Yeah, and it's about removing all the kind of limited hangouts or factionality that tries to fight to govern these institutions. It's the ANCAPs and the 3D printer gun people and the Black Lives Matter are essentially attacking the same problem from different angles, but one of them has a much better systematic idea of how to actually do change rather than just,
If you stopped sort of, I don't know, bickering between people who are ultimately inconsequential and are only looking to, garner some more shekels from the state, you would instead be much more sort of, what would the phrase be, effective to use your time in fighting the state that they get the shekels from.
Well, it's again to round it out because I think we're getting towards the 2 hour mark now. Good
Oof.
Lord! Thanks again for sticking with us, by the way. There's been pretty consistent amount of you guys, so thanks for staying with the rambling and thank you for the generous donations. Where people have been very, very good today.
Has there been any others?
There has been a $2 donation here from Glowy again, saying it's funny that we went from leader is God on Earth, like Pharaoh and Emperor of Japan, to everyone is just a man, to the leaders of the states are gods on Earth again. Well, I don't think we really move. It's kind of weird. Time and men's ideology seems circular. It's kind of weird in that...
I wouldn't necessarily say that leaders used the divine right of kings, not in that they said that God gave them the right to rule. It was more the fact that they were some of the only people agreed upon at the time, whether for genuine or not, that through God they could rule. It's slightly different.
Yeah. It's an intro. We're probably going to have to, again, do that as not a dead... Maybe a shorter form thing, but the difference between how kings... excised power, yeah, and how total, well, states
excised
power.
Maybe that's something, I don't know, the people in chat can give us feedback on just now or not, but as slightly more short form sort of non-live content that would sort of describe definitions or pockets of stuff that people still aren't quite grasping, or that we think is sort of an interesting idea that could be elucidated in 20-30 minutes. Is that something that they would look forward to or view, essentially?
I think there's a lot of hunger there for just content in general. I know we really only do these once a week, but I think if we did try and do like a supplementary framework stuff on specific topics,
yeah.
I'm hoping at some point, maybe on a different channel even, to chop up the democratization series into smaller episodes that are much more viewable.
Yeah, no, I think it's probably worth keeping all in the same place, to be honest. It's more that we can do things that kind of branch out from specifically this narrative and sort of stand in their own as then something that could be referenced within this.
Yeah. It's just like, if you want to see how this works in a historical context, you know, refer to our democratization series.
Because I think one I wanted to do would essentially be, even though it's maybe a bit sort of outplayed, would essentially be a description of, you know, why Hitler to a certain extent is the total formulation really of everything that we are up against.
Yeah.
You know, he is, and the as much as you hate the way I pronounce this word, the epitome of republicanism.
Epitome, and but yes.
Anti-religiosity.
Yes, it's, again, it's interesting, and there's lots of, the thing is, once we kind of started drawing from this well of ideas, it's just amazing just how much there is left in there.
Well, there's Doge of Phobos is mentioned there. Part of what we were considering is the fact that as I have started writing some of my own stuff, that we could essentially do sort of short form content on the articles and the points that they maybe elucidate in a different fashion, or maybe even to a certain extent and maybe in a live form sit and discuss them with.
Yeah, I think we'll probably end up doing both Doge of Phobos, because I think having written companions to video pieces is the most complete way to get ideas out there, because one is better at communicating one way and one is better at communicating another. When you have both of them, it can really, really give people a much more total idea of what you're going for. Also, people just prefer watching things, and some people prefer reading things. So that takes time investment, though.
Mm.
And it's something that I'd need to work up to, and I guess we'd need to work up to a bit more. But I guess I don't have a huge amount of stuff on at the moment. It's just, again, it literally is a week's worth of reading to get each of these streams done.
Mm.
So maybe there'll be a little bit more during this week, since we've basically got a complete document for the Keynesianism stream next week.
Yeah, maybe we could try a sort of trial run of something at some point this week then, because I don't know, I have some ideas that I might try and put down to paper, or shall we say digital paper, and I don't know if then that's something we could try and do some sort of writing on between, I don't know, or writing and then possibly content on between now and Thursday.
Well, there's something to be said here that the British Knight was talking about, that face when you're accused of being the very culmination of your enemy, SMH. It's kind of funny, but I also like your idea of just tactically just owning the thing and saying, well, functionally to you, we are the bogeyman. Like, there's...
Well, that's Lenin again.
It's
Lenin understood the power of terror, and ergo he set up the terror state.
It's like the opposite of being obsessed with optics. If you can, like, scare the shit out of people.
It's sort of inverse optics or anti-optics, which is why I've taken my own sort of realm of writing articles in what I regard as anti-politics.
It's quite funny in that these are very complex kind of sometimes esoteric, historical, philosophical, and kind of ethical frameworks we talk about. But if you really listen to the series and you really understand the logical implications of the ideas we're putting forward, they are much more radical and much more spicy than, a lot of the content that gets removed and zeroed in on for being, quote unquote, dangerous.
Yes.
This is actually much more dangerous to the people who are in power than, a lot of the things they seem to obsess over. But because it is put forward in such a plain way and is, in a sense quite irrefutable, and in longer form as well and being more complex helps, but it's easy to fly under the radar as well in this kind of stuff. Because it's very difficult for a lot of the people who get very upset
And
to actually understand what you're
yeah,
talking about.
and that's why if people are willing to join us, it will become more esoteric whilst inversely becoming more insightful.
Yes, you can really, once you get into this, the idea of building more of an in-group language, to actually understand the logical implications of what we're saying here, they'd have to engage with the ideas of Austrian economics, which the people who would report us to the authorities mentally aren't capable of doing, because if they were, they wouldn't be those people. It's quite funny that you can essentially hide your quote unquote more extreme ideas in the language of something like Austrian economics. Because the people who don't understand that framework are the very people who would be, most offended by it. I don't know. It's a bit of a, again, its own esotericism, but I think what we do here is a lot more spicy than maybe certain people who are outside of it would realize, and that's what I quite like about it. It's almost subversive in a way, and it can come across quite dry, but if you get the hook of it and if you do the reading of it, you can understand more of why we are saying what we're saying and why what we think what we're saying is so needed right now. Again, it's something I would be doing if nobody was really watching, because I want to try and sharpen these ideas myself. And it's just something I want to put to, I guess put to screen. It's almost like put to paper, but for the comfort of my own mind and my own conscience, I don't think I'd be able to keep reading what I'm reading and keep thinking what I'm thinking and keep doing what I'm doing if I didn't get it out there in some form or another, because that would drive me insane. It's, you know, it's
Tell me about
it's it's the
it.
it's the kind of the end point of the writer writes for himself, not for you, but it's kind of true in that I'm doing this because it brings me immense, in a way, personal satisfaction and some level of peace of mind, because it's a really great way of working out, where I am and what I think and what I think we can do about all of this. And I'm glad you guys have come on this journey with, because this has been the culmination of, obviously you see me and Trig mostly out front, and you're essentially our third
Smoking man in the
yeah
background.
you are the smoking man in the background who brings us all these ideas, but we are, like most people, standing on the shoulders of giants with the Austrian school stuff and all the writers we referenced, and we're essentially showing you the giants we're standing on here. It's quite, again, it's quite humbling, really, to once you understand this as well. I think this is the last rambling point that I'll make before we leave, but a lot of what we've recommended to you is the kind of the true heirs of the liberal tradition, and there is a whole lot of liberal canon behind them that you can read
Yes.
that really is, again, even more underpinning of this. We'll probably get to it again at some point, but it's a case of, once you get to 1900, as we demonstrated, and the death of the classical liberals, all of that is really dead. It had been limping throughout the 1900s because of a lot of the utilitarianism and a lot of the Whiggism and a lot of the do-gooder feelings and Christian socialism stuff. But this inherits the liberal canon. This is, the heir of the liberal canon, and that's very powerful. And it's something that I don't think conservatism can draw on. They have very limited ideas, specifically for conservatism, but this is so rich in context, and there's so much to mine here that I think we can keep doing this essentially forever in many ways.
That's the plan.
That is the plan. So thank you guys for watching. Thank you guys for continuing to stick with us during this slightly rambling outro, because I did say we'd end like 10 minutes ago.
That's how you know it's a good one, though.
It is good. And again, you can click on Evelyn's stuff below. They are DG in a string of numbers on social media. They're
palindromic numbers, so you can see the patterns and be as schizo as I am.
But yeah, you can find some of their writing over on their Substack, which is linked, I think, on their Twitter.
It is, yes.
You're still on Twitter for now. Again, join my Discord, follow me on Minds, and if you've not watched it already, watch the rest of the playlist, because we're trying to build something here, and I'd like to bring a lot of you guys along with us. So, thank you and good night.
Goodbye.
Ooh, there we go.
Oh.